For those of you that don't know me, I'm Sarah Kimmons, and my research group is located on the beautiful St. Ann de Bellevue campus of McGill, and I'm in the Animal Science Department. So it's really my pleasure to introduce today a really dynamic personality and quite a force in male reproductive health, Dr. Peter Chan. So to give you some background on our speaker, Dr. Peter Chan did his residency in urology here at McGill. After that, he did his fellowship training at Cornell, followed by a stint at Rockefeller at the Population Council. And then we were lucky to capture him back at McGill. And he's been involved in really cutting-edge research in male reproductive health for over 20 years now. He's held many grants from the CIHR as principal investigator and as an excellent collaborator. And more recently, he has been moonlighting as a TV star, and you can see him on the series Doctorology on the Discovery Channel. So I believe his talk today is going to be a really wonderful counterpart to Dr. Woodruff's talk this morning. We heard about preserving fertility in female patients that are being treated for cancer, and Peter's going to talk to us today about preserving fertility and restoring fertility in males that have undergone cancer treatment.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sarah, for the introduction. I'd like to thank all of you staying for this part of the presentation and also for the society for inviting me to give this talk. So what I'll be doing in the next 20-25 minutes or so is to talk about the impact of cancer on the reproduction on the male side, which is a complement of the first talk we had today by Dr. Woodruff. So one thing I want to mention is that when we talk about cancer and infertility, what kind of cancers are we talking about? Generally, the type of cancer that we hear a lot about in men, things like prostate cancer, lung cancer, colon cancer, these are not the type of cancer we talked about, because these are the type of cancer that generally happen to men after their reproductive age. But the kind of cancer that we are talking about are the ones who affect more men or boys before they begin forming families. So things like testis cancer, which incidentally is the most common type of cancer in men in the reproductive age. Hodgkin, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, AML, these are some of the cancer that we are talking about that affect boys or young men at the reproductive age. Now, interestingly, cancer statistics worldwide indicated that many of these so-called childhood cancer, the incidence is on the rise, that is more and more commonly we see them affecting young boys and men. In particular, Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and here we're showing the data of testis cancer. In different countries worldwide in the past couple of decades, that it is really on the rise. So this is really something that is concerning. So there's a growing population of young men and boys being affected by these cancer. Fortunately, the combination chemotherapy that is available in the recent years really improved the survival rate for these patients. So you can see the mortality rate is clearly declined with many of these cancer conditions that we encounter. So basically what happened is that we will have a growing population of young men who will survive these type of cancer, and they will need help for their fertility treatment for that. So many of these patients, because they haven't started forming family or completed forming family, so that's why it's an important issue in their survivorship, what we call that. Now, interestingly, the question is that do these patients who survive cancer want to have children? A survey done in the United States showed that actually they do. Many of these cancer survivors actually want to be parents. 76% of these survivors who don't have children want to be parents. And the big majority of these patients feel that their cancer experience actually make them better parents, and most of them feel that they're healthy enough to be good parents. So clearly, there's a need to address this fertility issue for patients who survive cancer. Now, it's a very complex psychological issue when we talk about the fertility issue in cancer survivor, because there was a lot of concern in their mind. The fear of dying from their cancer, not being able to have children because of the treatment that they have received that compromised their fertility. The risk of passing their cancer or any kind of bad condition to their children, genetic defect, things like that. Another important one is that they may not be able to see their children to grow old if they cannot live long enough. This is not just to see their children grow. This is an important factor also for their children to know who the parents is and for the parent to pass down any kind of wisdom that may have to the children. So these are some of the important aspects when we address this complex issue of fertility, the ability of children after cancer. Now, in one of the old movies starring Michael Keaton and Nicole Kidman called My Life, one of the older movies, basically this is a story about a couple, and Nicole Kidman is expecting their first child. And unfortunately, Michael Keaton, the father, was diagnosed with advanced cancer, and he knows that he won't make it to see their first child. So what he did is that in order for the child to learn about who the father is and to pass down his wisdom to the children, he made a series of videotape just so in the future the kids can learn about that. So that really highlights the importance of the complex psychological issue when we address these kind of fertility problem in cancer survivor. Now, of course, the impact of for cancer treatment like radiation and chemotherapy is something that can compromise the fertility. And the impact of that really depends on the type of chemotherapy or treatment you have and the duration of the treatment. So there's a huge variety of chemotherapy agents available to treat different kind of cancer, and they have a different extent of impact on their fertility treatment for that. Now, how does the chemotherapy agent, which is the focus of our talk here today, affect the male reproduction? We don't have to explain that in the testes there is a pool of different kind of germ cell that is existing in the testicle. If you look at the entire cell population from spermatogonia, spermatocytes, spermatids to mature spermatozoa, these could be target for chemotherapy. As an example, if the chemotherapy or radiation therapy affect these cells in the later on in the spermatogenic cycle, they can cause damage in the genetic material of these cells. But if the impact of these chemotherapy or radiation affect the spermatogonia stem cell, they can actually affect many generations of the sperm that is developed from that. So there is a long-term impact if the DNA structure is disturbed in these cells in the early stage of the development in the spermatogenesis. So that's why it is something that is very concerning of the impact of these agents in the fertility. Now, when we talk about the clinical impact of chemotherapy agent on infertility, what exactly are we talking about? Are we talking about a decline in semen parameters? Are we talking about a decline in the sperm aneuploidy rate or the sperm DNA or chromatin integrity? Or we talk about something more clinical, like it takes longer to achieve pregnancy, adverse fetal outcome, low birth weight, malformation. What exactly are we talking about when we talk about negative impact in the reproductive health? Now, all of these are important factors for that. But of course, you may think that finding out the actual baby that is born, if there's any defect in those people, would be the most important question that one should ask. In fact, there has been paper addressing this issue. Now, in this particular paper, they are following children that were born from father who received chemotherapy, one group who received a very strong chemotherapy, one group with milder form of chemotherapy, and they compare the risk of genetic defect of these children born by these father with the children from the sibling of these cancer patients. Now, this looks like a very clever control because the sibling would have the same exposure as the patient with any kind of toxin or any kind of genetic problem they have. So that seems like a very good control group to look at that. And what they found is that if you look at the percentage of offspring with genetic defect, it's quite similar across the range. So it shows from the conclusion is that the chemotherapy agent, whether you have the strong one or the mild one, it doesn't increase the risk of genetic problem in the offspring. That was the conclusion. Now, there was a lot of criticism about this. So the impression of that chemotherapy doesn't affect the fetal outcome is the conclusion that they drew. But there's a lot of problem with that. If you go back to look at the data, although the percentage seems to be very similar and comparable for the three groups, the actual number of offspring that is generated is a lot less if you receive strong chemotherapy or any kind of chemotherapy compared to the offspring. So it is possible that although the children that were actually made it to be born, they don't have a high risk of malformation. They may have a higher risk of miscarriage or early arrest in pregnancy. So there may be other kind of adverse fetal outcome that you cannot measure just by looking at the baby that made it to be born, because there was a lot of natural selection barrier that may be able to eliminate bad sperm, bad embryo, things like that. So they may have high risk early miscarriage. So that data really doesn't really confirm whether there's a risk of genetic malformation in children who were born by father who had chemotherapy. If we look at how bad the impact is, what kind of data do we have available? We have a lot of animal model and some retrospective series. There are some small prospective series, but many of these studies, they have a very small sample size, very mixed cancer population. So it's very hard for us to draw the conclusion, especially when you don't have any pre-chemotherapy data for you to compare to find out if there's any change in their semen quality when we try to address the actual impact of chemotherapy on the reproductive health. So in view of these shortages in the information that we have in the literature, there was a big study that was funded by the CIHR. There was one big study that was headed by Dr. Bernard Robert that we were part of this big team. What we have done is that it's a multidisciplinary study to try to address the chemotherapy impact on the reproductive health in general. And there were three major projects in this big multidisciplinary grant. I was involved in the clinical aspect to study the impact of patients who receive chemotherapy. There was another study looking at the psychosocial aspect. The reason why is because the point that we made earlier that there was a lot of complex psychosocial issue with these patients. So one part of that project is to address the psychosocial needs for these patients. And also we have a parallel study in animal model for us to look at other aspects of the impact of chemotherapy on the reproductive health. So basically what we do in the clinical project is that we recruit patients who are about to undergo chemotherapy. So before they start the chemotherapy, they will go through different kinds of evaluation, psychosocial evaluation, hormonal semen analysis, different kind of genetic assay, and all of these patients obviously will be encouraged to bank sperm. And after they have finished their chemotherapy, we repeat these measurements again throughout the 2 years period to find out how things are changing after they finish their chemotherapy. So for the patient, we've looked at the data in the first group of patients who receive chemotherapy for testis cancer. Now, in this table, we are basically plotting the motile sperm concentration. So the higher the number, the higher the motile sperm concentration in the semen over different time point that we have in the follow-up. So you can see that at time zero, before chemotherapy begin, many of these patients have a good level of sperm. Some of these patients, they have low sperm count before they have chemotherapy. I put down the bar here. This is the World Health Organization for their reference value cutoff. So that is above the point that is above this bar. These are the patients who have a quote-unquote normal semen parameters. Below that is subnormal. And after chemotherapy begin, you can see that every single patient, they have a decline in their semen profile. And what happened in the subsequent time point for these patients, there was a big variety. We do see some patients, they have a recovery in their sperm profile. Some of these patients takes longer. Some of these patients can make it close to their pre-chemotherapy. But the big majority of these patients have a lower sperm count at the beginning of the chemotherapy. So that's the change we see in the semen parameter in testis cancer patient. Hodgkin lymphoma, similar presentation again. Again, every single patient dropped their semen profile after chemotherapy. Subsequently, some of these patients have some recovery, but there's still a lot of patients, they fall below that World Health Organization cutoff. Hodgkin lymphoma, they started out with pretty good level of sperm count, and after chemotherapy, again, every single patient have a drop in their semen profile. In their follow-up period, they seem to recover a bit faster than the testis cancer group that we see, and many of these patients have the level of sperm above the minimum or the reference value of the World Health Organization. So this is how the semen pattern is changing. Looking at the data, again, by number, virtually 100%, every single patient after chemotherapy have a decrease in the semen profile. Some of these patients actually became azoospermic, that is, there was no sperm in their semen during their follow-up period. Some of these patients have some recovery of the sperm count, but not all of these patients would get back to their pre-chemo status. At best, only about 50% of these patients can return the semen level back to the pre-chemo stage for that. So clearly, it shows that there was a negative impact in their semen parameters. But semen parameter is only one variable. In fact, semen parameter has its own limitation because semen parameter by itself is a very poor predictor of the reproductive outcome. What do I mean by that? If you look at the whole spectrum of semen parameter, you have people who have no sperm, azoospermic, and you have people who have very high sperm count level. And in the middle somewhere is the World Health Organization reference value. So in this whole spectrum, except when you're azoospermic, that is, you have no sperm, we know that these patients will have no chance to have children by the natural means. Or if you have very high normal range, we know that you have a pretty good chance. But in between, in that big spot, broad spectrum, it's very hard to predict just by sperm count how likely you can be successful to achieve natural pregnancy. And even with assisted reproduction, those IVF and things like that there, the sperm count by itself is not a very good predictor how successful you will be in achieving pregnancy with these technology. So the semen parameter is only one variable we are using to evaluate the reproductive health. The next step we want to find out is, does the chemotherapy affect other aspects, for example, the sperm aneuploidy? one technique that we can measure that is the multicolor fluorescent in situ hybridization, in which we use different kind of probes to find out the chromosome makeup of the sperm nucleus. And the reason why we're doing that is that normal sperm can have, for example, for the sex chromosome, either one, which is X chromosome, or the Y chromosome, which is going to give you a boy fetus when it fuses with the egg, the gamete for that. But if you have more than one sex chromosome, for example, if there's only XY, then this baby would have genetic defect when it fuses with the eggs to form an embryo. In this particular case, it would be the Klinefelter syndrome, that is, they would have an extra piece of X chromosome. Likewise, we can use different kind of probes for different kind of chromosome to find out the risk of the different genetic defect that could be formed if the sperm have aneuploidy. So this is one way we can use to measure the rate of aneuploidy, that is, how good the sperm is after chemotherapy. And this is one collaboration we did with Renee Martin from Calgary. What we found is that across different time points after chemotherapy in the Hodgkin lymphoma and Texas cancer group there, we found that even up to the final time point we have in 2 years of the study, that there was a higher rate of aneuploidy in the two group of cancer patients. In particular, the patient with Hodgkin lymphoma, despite the fact that we saw them that they have faster recovery in their semen profile after chemotherapy, they have a high rate of aneuploidy compared to the Texas cancer group. So the semen parameter, again, only gives you part of the story. When we look at the aneuploidy rate there, the Hodgkin group, which recovered the semen profile faster, they actually have a higher aneuploidy rate. So that's another marker that we use to show that there was negative impact of chemotherapy on the reproductive health. Besides aneuploidy, another way we can evaluate the sperm quality is to check their chromatin integrity. Now, what do I mean by that? These are different techniques that has been used in the biology reproduction laboratory for a long period of time. Tunnel assay looking for apoptosis, comic assay to look at the DNA scattering on electrophoresis, other kind of assay, DNA fragmentation that can be used to evaluate the sperm chromatin integrity. We applied a panel of these assays to evaluate the sperm quality after chemotherapy also, and this is the data that we found. I'm going to show you the result of the SCSA, which is a sperm chromatin structure assay, to look at the so-called DNA fragmentation rate. So basically, this is a graph plotting different time points with the DNA fragmentation rate. The higher the fragmentation rate, the worse your sperm would be. That's the basic point for this. So first, we look at our healthy control group at different time point. You can see that these patients, they have some variability, but overall, their fragmentation rate is not so bad on the lower side. But if you look at patients who are infertile, these are our control group, they're infertile patients, nothing to do with cancer, just that we want to see infertility, what kind of level of DNA fragmentation we have. You can see that these patients have a high fragmentation rate at different time points, same group of patients, so there is some variability in these patients for that. How about our cancer patient? Let's start with our testis cancer group of patients. Now, let's say the 10% is our cutoff for the good and the bad DNA fragmentation rate. How is the testis cancer group patient panned out? You can see that after chemotherapy, many of these patients, they have a higher rate of DNA fragmentation. This is the red bar of the testis cancer patient. Post-chemotherapy, higher DNA fragmentation rate up to the last time point of 2 years that we have done the evaluation. So that's on the testis cancer group that they have an increase in the DNA fragmentation rate. How about the Hodgkin lymphoma group? Interestingly, these patients, they started out even before chemotherapy with a relatively high fragmentation rate compared to the other group of patients. And after chemotherapy, you kind of see a decline in their fragmentation rate. But the main point is that even up to 2 years of waiting, we still see a fair percentage of these patients remain to have a high DNA fragmentation rate. So again, looking at these number, these figures by number again, we have some patients, they have high fragmentation rate even before you start the chemotherapy, which means that they may be more prone to further damage if you give them chemotherapy. Some of these patients, they have a persistent DNA fragmentation rate after chemotherapy. But again, the main point is that even up to 2 years at the end of this particular study, still a fair percentage of patients have a higher DNA fragmentation rate compared to the pre-chemotherapy. So clearly, based on semen parameter, aneuploidy, sperm chromatin, we do see a negative impact in the sperm quality for that. So how do we preserve fertility if there's a damage for that? The best way to do that is to bank sperm. So sperm banking is the key thing to preserve their fertility at the present time. How do we bank sperm for the patient? The only way that we can bank sperm is to freeze the sperm that is produced by ejaculation. This is the only clinically feasible way we have to preserve fertility. Other strategy has been looked at, for example, using GnRH analog to try to suppress germ cell division, to calm the germ cells so that they're not actively dividing. Maybe they will be less of a target for chemotherapy. This is one strategy that has been looked at. Unfortunately, in human, there has been no success yet at this point. Another strategy is to see if we can harvest the spermatogonia stem cell and transplant them back to the testis after chemotherapy so that they can escape the attack from chemotherapy and then repropagate spermatogenesis activity for that. So these are the different strategies that has been looked at. But the only one that is available now is sperm banking. How do we bank sperm? This is not how we bank sperm. Sperm banking is not done that way. Sperm banking is done by cryopreservation. The way we bank sperm is that we would freeze the sperm with liquid nitrogen and store them. It has to be done before the first dose of chemotherapy. The time to arrange this kind of treatment is critical. Sometimes chemotherapy has to begin last week. So you really have sometimes not enough time for you to really pay attention to the abstinence period, things like that. The issue with cost, because these procedures, they can still be costly. The last thing a cancer patient needs is a surprise with a bill that they have to pay for sperm banking, things like that. Key thing is to have a dedicated counselor to guide them through this kind of procedure to encourage them to bank sperm for them. Do cancer patients actually bank sperm? Well, based on earlier study, not the majority of patients, they would actually bank sperm before chemotherapy. In fact, in some studies, they show that two-thirds of the patients, they don't even recall that option being discussed with them. So what factor really influenced their intention to bank sperm? This is one of the main points with the psychosocial expert that we addressed in that grant with Dr. Robert. In this paper, we tried to look at different kind of factor that is important to influence the decision of sperm banking. And what we have identified is that the following information is very important. That is the number one most important factor. And that is if you have a dedicated healthcare professional on site to explain, to walk them through the procedure, that would be one best way to encourage them to bank sperm. Other factor, their attitude towards survival. If they think they're dying, obviously, they don't want to bank sperm. You have to make it very simple for them. If you tell them you have to make an appointment at a certain time of the day, do this and do that, it's likely going to discourage them from going forward for that. Cost is a factor. Also, if you have a parent for the young patient or a partner, they're more likely to be encouraged to bank sperm. The fatherhood status, patients who already have children, obviously they are less likely to be too keen on banking sperm for that. Also their perception, how important it is for fatherhood to them. Those are some of the factors. Sexual orientation, obviously some patients who are homosexual orientation, they are less concerned with the ability to father children than the other type. Cultural orientation is also very important for these patients. But one thing important to know is that if you have no spermatogenesis, there is nothing we can do. We cannot do anything else at the current time clinically to preserve their fertility. So to explore other options for these patients, one thing we're trying to develop as many other laboratories in the world has been trying to do is to apply stem cell technology to see if we can retrieve a spermatogonia stem cell and preserve them. So the key question that is being asked by these researchers, including ours, is that can we isolate and preserve these spermatogonia stem cells? And one thing important to know is that for sperm banking, we need spermatozoa, which only happen after puberty, as you know. But spermatogonia stem cells exist throughout the entire, since birth you will have that. So that's one good source that you can retrieve spermatogonia stem cells to preserve fertility. And if we can retrieve these spermatogonia stem cells before chemotherapy, there is a chance we can bring them back to the seminiferous tubule after chemotherapy to repropagate the population of cells to continue spermatogenesis. So in this particular case, we are not just preserving fertility, we're actually restoring the fertility capacity. What do I mean by that, fertility restoration? Because when you bank sperm, you have a limited quantity of sperm that you can use. One day you're going to run out if you use multiple times for these sperm material for assisted reproduction. But if we can repropagate the sperm production, we may be able to have a longer-term supply of sperm cells. So that's one advantage of restoration beyond just preservation for that. And the spermatogonia stem cell, if you take it away from the body before chemotherapy exposure, these spermatogonia stem cell may have better quality. Because we have seen that after chemotherapy, the surviving spermatogonia stem cell may have DNA damage. So the one that we take out and we harvest them, maybe they're cleaner for the genetic material aspect. So maybe the sperm that is generated would have better quality than the sperm that is surviving in the patient after chemotherapy. So this way to preserve the spermatogonia stem cell is particularly important for the pre-adolescent cancer patient, that is before they have spermatogenesis, that they do not have sperm we can find to burn, to bank. So these patients with the spermatogonia stem cell technology may be the only hope we can preserve their fertility. And basically, the technology that has been developed, this is the work with Dr. Makoto Nagano from our group, who is one of our close collaborators, working on, and that is we harvest testicular tissue to make a single-cell suspension, and using magnetic cell sorting to find out markers for the spermatogonia stem cell, we have the potential to isolate them and then propagate and preserve them and hopefully transplant them back to the seminiferous tubule to allow spermatogenesis to happen. So this is the basic scheme that we're trying to develop to repropagate spermatogenesis for that. Not an easy thing to do. Besides the scientific hurdle we have to overcome, there are other kind of psychosocial aspects we have to address. For example, are people ready for that? Healthcare professional, the patient, the parents, are they ready for us to do an invasive procedure to harvest stem cell when they are facing cancer diagnosis and cancer treatment for that? Is the society ready for us to do this kind of procedure? So these are some of the issues we have to pay attention. For example, these procedures, they are still very experimental. It is invasive because we have to do a procedure in a young boy to harvest spermatogonia stem cell. And we cannot necessarily promise these patients that we can deliver the promise that we can preserve the spermatogonia stem cell to allow them to have sperm production after. So many of these issues is something we have to look at to address them before we can apply these in the actual setting in pediatric population. Keep in mind one thing. We have to know that for these young patients who may not even think about fertility option for that, is it something really important for them? We only know young adults who survive cancer, fertility is important. But for these pre-adolescent cancer, their mindset is something that has not been studied previously. And also, again, these patients, when they have the diagnosis of cancer, trying to hit them with different kind of experimental protocol, the timing may not be perfect when they're focusing their energy in cancer treatment for them. It may be open up a huge Pandora box because these experimental procedures have a lot of implication, especially the needs of assisted reproduction, the cost behind it, the potential genetic issue, and the ethical issue of using these material by the parents. These are some of the issues we have to examine very carefully before we get too excited with the scientific aspect of the development for that. So fortunately, we have further research opportunity by the CIHR. We recently received two grants from the CIHR looking at exactly this issue to focus on the development of the basic science aspect for the sperm cell, spermatogonia stem cell technology, and also to study the psychosocial and the ethical aspect of the fertility restoration for the pre-adolescent patients. So I think one thing to be very clear in our mind is that we are facing a growing and an existing population of young patients who will survive cancer. And the challenge is that many of these patients, they would want to know about their option for fertility preservation and fertility treatment for that matter. Especially here in Quebec, soon assisted reproductive technology, those IVF procedures, will be covered by the provincial health care. So the access is going to increase tremendously in future. So that's why we have to be prepared as a scientist and as a clinician, as a psychologist, to face these kind of questions, to know how to deal with these patients and how to counsel these patients. So in summary, there was a big impact that we have seen with chemotherapy and cancer on the reproductive health in different aspects, sperm parameter, aneuploidy, and sperm chromatin. And I think it should be important to address that there is a risk, therefore, not just in the sperm level, but it may translate into adverse fetal outcome in the future. So this is something that is very serious for these patients to consider. Again, sperm banking is the only way so far we have to preserve fertility, but for patients who do not mix sperm, pre-adolescent children, for example, I think the development of the spermatogonia stem cell technology could be one promising step we can help them to preserve their fertility. Now, this kind of work is clearly a multidisciplinary approach. We have a lot of basic scientists to focus on the different molecular assay, development of new assay to help us to develop a strategy to preserve fertility. We have clinicians trying to get these basic technology to be translated into usable form for the patient. We also need a lot of psychosocial professionals, ethicists, psychologists to look at the other aspect beyond the science, beyond the clinical science of the feasibility of these techniques. What is the impact on these patients? And these people really have to work together very closely, because the ultimate goal with these interactions is to benefit the patient at the end of the day. So I think this model with the multidisciplinary approach is the key thing to address the need of this group of patients. So this kind of work would not be possible without different collaboration. We have different collaborators, Dr. Tan from the Reproductive Center at McGill, Dr. Hermo, Dr. Desilet, Dr. Abaco from Health Canada. Spermochromatin work is with collaboration with Dr. Robert, Dr. Hales, Geraldine, and Christian O'Flaherty. And the adult cancer subject study was done with the Montreal Oncology Group, different people, and the employability rate with the Calgary Group, and the psychosocial study with Dr. Ross Berger, Dr. Achille, and Dr. Baus from Calgary, and Dr. Makoto Nagano with the spermatogonia stem cell development, and finally the pediatric group with, again, Dr. Achille, Dr. Tressler, and the Montreal Children's Hospital, St. Justin Hospital. These are all of our collaborators, along with our funding group, CIHR and FRSQ. So I just want to thank them for the collaboration. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions you may have.
I have a question that you could answer probably both at the clinical and basic level. If you're talking about doing transplantation back into the testis of a patient post-chemotherapy, what's known about the effect of the chemotherapy on the Sertoli and Leydig cells? Because obviously if you're bringing the sperm, the stem cells back into a not very normal environment, that's not going to help either.
Yeah, absolutely right. I think this is one of the big unknown questions we have. We are not quite there yet at the transplantation phase, because still trying to play with the stem cell technology. Because before you even get to that point, another big question with the cancer patient is that how pure is the cell population? You don't want to harvest spermatogonial stem cell that is contaminated with cancer cell either. So there's a lot of questions we're still trying to answer to find out if that whole scheme is going to work out for that. And those Sertoli cell and Leydig cell function are the key question to answer before we know if these stem cells can develop further.
Hugh Clark from McGill. Well, I guess we're all from McGill, most of us. Obstetrics and gynecology. I was interested in you mentioned the Maastricht study and the criticism that maybe they weren't taking into account embryos that might have been lost due to miscarriage. So that's something that probably could be looked at, or something like time required to conception for cancer survivors. Has that been looked at, whether there's a higher rate of miscarriage?
Yeah, there has been longer time to conception for these patients. And just anecdotally, in our prospective cohort, we have a lot of problem in these cancer patients who try to achieve pregnancy either naturally or through assisted reproduction. So I think it is a real concern, but I think bigger population study would be the key thing to find out the extent. One of the major issues is that if you look at study that is lumping many cancers together, it's very hard to find the final conclusion for that. And that's why in our case, we're sticking to three common cancers to try to find out the actual impact. But I think the time to conception, the fetal loss is a major factor in, that can cause adverse fetal outcome in these patients. Teresa?
Teresa Woodruff, Northwestern. Peter, terrific work and presentation. And we also have seen poor sperm quality and low sperm number in the Hodgkin's patients in particular. Have you correlated your sperm quality or number data to age?
We have, actually. Because the age group of our patient, they are relatively narrow. Most of these patients, they're between the age of 18 to about 30. Because one of the cutoff for our recruitment is that we don't take anyone beyond the age of 40. So I think age factor would be very important in this particular group. But because of the limitation that those patients, they usually don't want to have children further. So that's why we're limited to below 40 for that. So in our particular group, that with the age, we didn't find the major differences in their correlation.
No,
we didn't find that.
Okay, because we're seeing a difference in the younger patient. And this leads to kind of a clinical question, which is how you counsel these patients, and do you give sperm quality data back to the patients with that initial tube? And as you said, the sperm quality is not terribly good afterwards. So what message are you giving the
patients? We have been modifying our counseling almost like every year at the present time. When I first started, before we have any data, we follow some of the loose data in the literature, and that is don't try to have kids until 1 year after your chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. Now, where did that 1 year come from? It's really out of thin air for that. Does that mean waiting longer is better, waiting short? Because they're based on the sperm anomaly in the first year post-chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. But does that mean waiting longer is better? So that was the party line we used to use at the beginning. After we have these form of data that we told them that, you know, there was still going to be a risk we don't know until you try. And that's the only fair statement we can make now. And we may change even further when we have more reproductive outcome to find out what we can actually tell these patients.
Right, but I think that the other issue is whether or not the initial sperm sample is
exactly of
good quality or not, and should you use
exactly
natural conception versus that?
That's the million-dollar question. Which sperm do you use, the recover sperm after or the pre-chemotherapy bank sperm?
Lloydie Majewska, Department of Pediatrics. I actually have two questions. The first question is a follow-up to the last one about the age of your patients. So your study was for 2 years. Depending on the age, they might have a difference in their outcome. Are you going to follow patients longer than 2 years in the subsequent studies?
Depends on the actual. It costs a lot of money.
It always depends on them, right? And my last question is, when you take the sperm out before chemotherapy starts, so you're looking at three specific cancer cases, and you have different translocations that might be associated, do you see a difference in the genetic lesion or predisposition to the type of cancer that the patients will have? Have you done any array data to look at the type of mutations and the type of sperm you're getting out?
No, but that would be something interesting to look at for that. We didn't do this part.
Alex Shulevsky, Hugh Clark Lab. I just have a question about sperm banking. I know you said that it was the most effective method of maintaining male fertility, but only 15 to 30% of males do it. So I have kind of a two-part question. Of that 15 to 30%, how many were successful in having children later on? And do you think it's just as important to get that number up as it is to pursue other avenues of research in maintaining male fertility?
Yeah, good question. I think the one thing is that for the patient who banks sperm, before we can answer what is the success of them achieving pregnancy, which is a multifactorial thing, depending on the female partner, depending on the quality of the sperm, not all of the patients who bank sperm end up using their bank sperm either. And I think it's not just because they forget about it or anything like that. But I think some of these patients, they have sperm recovered, so they don't go back to use the sperm, or maybe they die. That's why the sperm becomes an orphan sample that is nobody's claiming them for. These are the different variables for them. And the other part is that at the time of counseling, they were naive to the technology that is available now. I still hear a lot of old-time oncologists tell the patient, number one, oh, the cancer therapy wouldn't affect your fertility. It will be no difference. Second myths that they try to spread is that there was no chance you can have sperm when you have low sperm count. No chance you can have children when you have low sperm count. But they didn't know about the availability of these technology. I think these are the information and the education side that makes these bank sperm underused, number one. And you're right, to increase the sperm banking rate, it was the primary goal of our entire study for that. But the development of this new technology is basically to focus not just to restore fertility in those men who can bank sperm, but for pre-adolescent, when we have no other options available. That was the reason behind that second part of the development of the strategy for that. But I agree with you, encouraging the sperm banking is a key thing. And overall, worldwide, I think the trend is that people, they're more and more aware of this option. So I think the sperm banking rate in newest data would be a lot better than a study that was published a decade ago. Thank you very much for your time.